Lionel Hampton opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with his recording of Blue Because of You. Today on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Australian writer Thomas Keneally, whose new book just won the most prestigious British literary award, the Booker MacDonald Prize for Fiction. His new novel, Schindler's List, is based on the life of Oskar Schindler, a German industrialist who, during World War II, set up benign work camps and benign concentration camps, where he sheltered and fed Jews and protected them from the real concentration camps. Keneally is also the author of The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, a novel about a half-white Australian, half-Aboriginal boy. This novel was made into an acclaimed Australian film. At about 3:45, we'll be joined by Peter Max, whose psychedelic art seemed to be everywhere in the late 60s and early 70s. He took an 8-year hiatus from the public eye while he painted at home in his studio. A show of his work opens tomorrow at the Halliwell Gallery in Norristown. Fresh Air's film critic Bill Van Wert will be with us at 3:30 to review the latest Werner Herzog film called Fitzcarraldo that stars Klaus Kinski. Public radio producer Gail Pellet recently studied journalism in China. Several months ago, we heard her documentary on Chinese students' attitudes towards sexuality. Today at 3 o'clock, we'll hear her documentary on Chinese journalism. The great pianist Al Haig died earlier this week of a heart attack at the age of 58. He first became known as Charlie Parker's pianist in the late 40s. In about a half hour, we'll hear the interview Fresh Air's Danny Miller recorded with Al Haig when he was in Philadelphia for a performance about a year and a half ago. With me now on Fresh Air is actor Milo O'Shea, currently starring in Mass Appeal at the Walnut Street Theater. He performed this role on Broadway and won the Outer Critics Circle Award, the Drama League Award, and a Tony nomination. Mass Appeal is a comedy about a priest who likes to give his parish the kind of sermon they're used to hearing, upbeat but kind of boring and innocuous. He likes to go to the horse races on Monday to rest from his sermons on Sunday and drinks liberally from his bottle of wine, which he keeps stored in a cabinet in his office. Adam Renfield co-stars as Mark Dawson, a seminary student who is studying with the priest and would like to deliver hard-hitting sermons about the superficial nature of middle-class trappings. Milo O'Shea just completed a movie with Paul Newman, which will be opening soon, probably in the next few weeks. It's called The Verdict. Milo O'Shea grew up in a small town just outside of Dublin and performed on stage and radio as a child. He later toured with the Abbey Players, the most famous Irish theater company, and then he moved to England, where he performed in many theater productions there. He made his Broadway debut in Staircase, which co-starred Eli Wallach, and then he co-starred with Angela Lansbury in Dear World and played with Ruth Gordon in Mrs. Warren's Profession. His films include Ulysses, Romeo and Juliet, Barbarella, Theater of Blood, and Sacco and Vanzetti. Mass Appeal continues at the Walnut Street Theater through November 28th, and for more information, you can call the box office at 574-3550. Milo O'Shea, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Does the theme of this play relate to your past at all? Did you come from a church-going family?
Yes, I did. I was brought up by the Christian Brothers in a little street called Sing Street, where, funnily enough, George Bernard Shaw was born. As a matter of fact, Shaw was born in Sing Street, and Singh was born in Shaw Street in Galway. A small bit of trivia. But yes, I had a sort of Catholic upbringing. I was an altar boy. I sang in the choir. And as I say, I was brought up by the Christian Brothers. But also in my family was a sort of theatrical background, in that my mother, in her youth, was a ballet dancer and was also a harpist. She played the concert harp. And my father was a semi-professional singer, so I think that there was a background there to draw from. And how I started off really acting was when I was at school in Sing Street. We had a very fine elocution teacher. Her name was Ina Mary Burke. And she entered me for some drama festivals, elocution competitions, which I won. And one of the adjudicators at one of these drama festivals was a radio producer who was looking for an Oliver to play in a new series of his Oliver Twist. And he asked me, would I play the part? And of course, I was delighted to, because it got me off a couple of hours at school every week. And so that's really where I started, on the radio. I played all the sort of boy parts, and then finally, after a couple of years, graduated onto the stage and played the boy parts on the stage.
Were you admired by your fellow students at the time?
I don't think so. They thought I was a bit of a sissy and a mammy's boy.
Acting wasn't manly, huh?
No, that's right. I should have been out kicking football and that kind of thing, you know. But I think they went along with it finally, there were actually in our school there were a lot of people who were Cornelius Ryan was in my class, and we had a lot of writers and painters and musicians and people of that ilk. So it wasn't too unusual to have an actor. And in fact, a number of my fellow students played. There was a very fine actor called Jackie McGowran, who was a great student of Beckett. He was in my, just ahead of me in the school, and my understudy, funnily enough, this, in Mass Appeal, was also at Sing Street. He was a couple of classes below me, I think.
So you got your start with this elocution teacher.
Yes.
Did you ever take acting, not acting lessons, but voice classes as a more mature adult?
Oh, yes.
What are some of the things that you learned there that help on stage?
Well, actually, funny enough, I mean, I did my schooling. I took a degree as a teacher of elocution in the London Guildhall of Music and Drama, and that helped a great deal, of course. And I also took some singing lessons and dancing lessons. Funnily enough, we were there again at school. We were taught Irish dancing, and it's very simple to go from Irish dancing to tap dancing. I mean, there's so many Irish Americans over here, like Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor and Dan Daly and Jimmy Cagney, who obviously had this Irish background. And it is, as I say, very easy to go from the tap dancing or from the step dancing to the tap dancing. I think that helped a great deal because I've done quite a few musicals, and of course, knowing how to dance is
important.
Great
help. So, but with elocution, what are some of the things that you would use now when you're on stage?
Well, naturally, you know, because the theatres that we play in now are covered usually with microphones, you don't need a very carrying voice. But in my day, you had to have a good voice that carried and that banged off the back of the wall, because otherwise you couldn't be heard. And so elocution was very important, and having good diction and because you'd be doing 8 shows a week, you have to have know how to use your voice properly so you don't overtire it.
In music, the microphone made soft singing possible, a kind of singing that you couldn't ever hear before in a concert hall.
Yes.
How do you think it's changed the acting profession to have microphones and the way an actor can speak on stage?
Well, I think it's very silly for an actor to rely on microphones, because that constantly... I remember I did a tour recently with Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady, and I refused to wear a mic because I was singing and dancing so much. I was playing Alfie Doolittle, the father. But we had microphones down in the footlights, so I said that I would prefer to rely on those. And I turned out to be right, because many, many times if you happen to be carrying one of these microphones and they went dead, because they often do, then... if you're not projecting and you don't know how to project, then you're really in trouble. Because if you turn up stage or if you move away from the microphone, then you can't be heard. Whereas if you're projecting properly, you can be heard.
When you were coming of age in Ireland, was it your goal to eventually come to America and perform on Broadway?
I don't think so. I just sort of came to America by chance many years ago, actually, 51, I came over with a young group called the Young Ireland Theatre Company. And we toured mostly the universities of the United States. But I fell in love with America then, and I lived over here at that period for about 3 years. And then I was trying to, of course, make my way in the theatre, and I felt that if I went back to Ireland and... I was a very young actor then. if I established myself as a name and a reputation, that it would be easier for me to get on in America. And that's what I did. I went back to Ireland, and I really studied my craft and worked with some very fine people, and then went to London and worked with, the first play I did there was for Sir John Gielgud, with Dame Sybil Thorndike and Sir Lewis Casson. And I worked with some very wonderful people over there and learned a great deal of my craft. And then finally, when I came back to America, I felt I'd served my time. I came back about 68, I think it was. I came back and did a play on Broadway with Eli Wallach called Staircase, which was a great success. I was nominated for a Tony Award for that. And I've been coming back to America ever since. I love America. I think they made a small mistake in putting the Irish Sea between Ireland and England. I think they should have put the Irish Sea between Ireland and America, because it's extraordinary. Plays like Neil Simon are always tremendously successful over in Ireland, and Irish plays are very successful over here. But America plays, for instance, Neil Simon isn't very successful in England, and Irish plays aren't very successful in England. Hmm. Much more successful over here in America.
Well, do you think that means anything?
Well, I think it means that the Irish in America are much closer. I think the sense of humor certainly is much closer. And, of course, the many millions of Irish that are here in America, I think, and there's a tremendous interest, naturally, between the two countries, interchange of culture and ideas which runs into problems when you try to bring them across the Irish Sea.
When you first came to the States and started acting on Broadway, I'm not familiar with most of the plays that you first acted in. Did you play Irish parts in them, or did you lose your brogue if you had one?
I have a brogue, actually. If I have a few jars and I relax, especially with Irish people, my accent is very strong. Also, I speak Gaelic. I'm an Isha Chainte Gaelic. I'm thinking to August. Is Doka Gwila Kuplizinia Abala on Shach, a Chainte Gaelic, Tamanisha, a Chainte Hang on Sassenach. A Hang on Sassenach means the tongue of the Saxon. I'm speaking now in the tongue of the Saxon. Gaelic is a beautiful language, and I think that is one of the reasons why the Irish are great writers, in that the Gaelic language is beautifully poetical, in that you would say hello. If you said hello to somebody, you'd say Gius Miracuch, which means may God and Mary be with you. And your reply to that would be Gius Miris Porrick, which means may God and Mary and St. Patrick be with you. And if you say goodbye to somebody, you say Gnairig an Boherlath, which means may your road rise heavenward. It's a very beautiful and poetical language, and I think that's where we get our poetry from. I think basically is from the Gaelic language, which of course we were forbidden to speak or write about. In fact, a poet could not write the word Ireland in poetry. You had to write about the Seán Bhean Bhocht, which means the poor old lady, or a dark Rosaline, or Roisin Dubh, which means Ireland also. In other words, that the poets wrote about this beautiful lady, which was the symbol of Ireland, or this poor old woman of the rose, which was, again, the poor symbol of Ireland.
Why couldn't you write Ireland?
It was forbidden by law, by British law. In fact, there are many, many, many things people over here in America are surprised about. For instance, wearing green on St. Patrick's Day, that was forbidden by law. You couldn't wear green and you couldn't have a parade. So when the Irish came to America and we found we could have a parade and we could wear green, they went absolutely bananas. That's why you have... For instance, if you go to Ireland, there are no parades on St. Patrick's Day because we don't have the tradition of parades. That's why it's such a wonderful thing to come to America and see that Irish people can actually walk and wear green, and wear shamrocks. You're forbidden by law to wear shamrock. And there were incredible old laws, like, for instance, you couldn't build a church on a main thoroughfare. If you could build a Protestant church, of course. And in fact, in Dublin, there are two cathedrals which are both Protestant. We have no cathedral there. Originally, of course, they were Catholic. But we have a pro-cathedral, which is 100 yards off the main thoroughfare. In other words, you couldn't build a church on the main thoroughfare. It had to be... And you know, some people are surprised that we're not terribly friendly with England. We are friendly now, and we'd be even more friendly. I don't think England, the English, realize what a wonderful little ally they would have beside them if they... became friendly neighbors to us.
Well, you spent several years in England performing there.
Many years, and I have some wonderful wonderful memories and very wonderful friends there.
Well, how did your political feelings about England and how it's treated Ireland and the English-Irish history affect your relationship on the stage with your fellow actors?
Well, that never really comes into... I'm not a political person at all. I'm very anti-political. I'm anti-violence. I'm anti-political. I'm anti-religion. And not that I'm anti-religion, but I'm anti-making one religion antagonistic towards another religion, which is done, unfortunately, in the occupied part of our country, which is very sad because... down in the Republic, in the 26 counties, you can be what you like. We've had Protestants who've been our presidents, wonderful presidents too, and Jewish Lord Mayors, and it doesn't matter a damn what you are, and that's the way it should be. But it's very sad to see that all this balance of power and sadness that goes on up in Northern Ireland is a very, very sad thing, and I think if the English realized that if they stopped that and if they really became concerned about the situation in Northern Ireland and dealt with it in an adult way, I think, as I say, the two countries would be wonderful friends.
I know you say you're not political, but is this a subject you tried not to bring up when you were in England with friends there? Or?
Oh, no. I think the average people over there don't understand. I think they're naturally their papers and their news media is very slanted over there. And so they really can't understand what all the confusion and trouble is up there. And they like to know. They like to get the other side of the story, which they're not usually presented with.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us and speaking with Milo O'Shea, who's starring in Mass Appeal, which is now at the Walnut Street Theater. And he originated that role on Broadway and received several awards for it. So getting back to something that we touched on before, when you came to the States and you had a stronger brogue, did you try to work to be able to consciously... eliminate that so that you could have more flexibility in the roles that you played?
I think so, yes. Also, the fact that I played a great deal in England and I've sort of played on both sides of the Atlantic, I think one develops a sort of mid-Atlantic accent that is not very Irish, it's not very English, and it's not American. I mean, when I go home to Ireland, they say, oh, you've got a terrible American accent. Which, of course, one naturally picks up intonations and phrases and colloquialisms that are certainly American. And, when I go on talk shows back there, they say, well, of course, you've lost your Irish accent. You've become terribly American. But to people over here, of course, I've got a sort of Irish-English accent. So, yes, I did. And my agent advised me... not to play too many Irish parts. Before I did Mass Appeal, I was doing a Cockney part, the father in My Fair Lady. And I've played all sorts of... I did a play for Mike Nichols on Broadway called Comedians, in which I played a sort of a North Country accent, English accent. Yes, I've tried to get away from a complete Irish image. Many years ago, especially here in America, people were only too keen to cast you, like Barry Fitzgerald always played Irish parts. He'd played nothing but Irish parts. And this, he was a very, very fine actor. And in fact, he won an Academy Award for one of his performances. But there again, he was limited terribly because they couldn't see him, or they wouldn't allow him to extend that field. Whereas I've been terribly lucky that I'm able to play on the stage in various different roles, and on television and on films and in musicals. And I've had a career on both sides of the Atlantic, so I've been very lucky.
The movie that you recently performed in, which will be opening in probably a couple of weeks or so, is called The Verdict, and Paul Newman is also featured in it. What can we expect from that film when it opens?
I think it's a very good film. First of all, it's a very fine director, Sidney Lumet, who has a great theatrical background and who likes to work with mostly theatrical people like Paul Newman and James Mason, who started many years ago in the Gate Theatre in Dublin. In fact, the Gate, the Abbey Theatre is known mostly over here as the sort of premier theatre, but actually, in my opinion, the Gate Theatre was the better company in that we did the international plays, and it also had wonderful people like Orson Welles and Geraldine Fitzgerald, and indeed Carol O'Connor got his training there also. But because the Abbey Theatre Company toured and worked out here quite a bit in the sort of 20s and 30s, it is better known out in America. But actually, the Gate Theatre has the better reputation in Europe. But Sydney has the... I'm sorry, I went off on a tangent there to get back to The Verdict. Sydney has this theatrical background and likes working with theatre people, in that instead of just going into the studio, as one usually does when you're making a film, and starting work, actually shooting, he had us working for a fortnight, 2 weeks before we began going into the studio at all, in a big rehearsal room. And he had the courtroom map taped out on the floor, and my chambers, my judge's chambers, and my home, where I have a scene with Paul Newman, in where he comes along and asks me to postpone the trial. And we rehearsed for 2 weeks, all these scenes, and that's basically why Sidney always comes in under budget and under schedule, because he's done his homework and because he knows exactly the shots he wants, and he knows exactly how the people are going to perform the scenes. And
you don't rehearse it with a camera, do you?
No. He just stands there and he says, I will be doing a two-shot here, or this will be a zoom shot. I'll start back here and I'll come in a zoom shot on this line or whatever it is, or this is going to be a panning shot. And that's very helpful for the actor, because if you say it's a long shot, naturally your performing will be more theatrical. And then if you know he's zooming in on you to have a very close shot, you will immediately take down your performance. So it's very important that you know this. And there are very, very few film directors. I think the only other one I worked with like that did rehearse beforehand was Franco Zeffirelli, when we shot Romeo and Juliet in Rome. He took us around to all the locations and we rehearsed on the locations, and that was very helpful. Also, I think because Franco has a theatrical background, and also he was an actor before he became a director. But I think this film, The Verdict, is going to be a very good, a wonderful film. Unfortunately, because I was making it during performances of Mass Appeal on Broadway, I didn't get to see any of the rushes, so I really haven't seen the film yet. But from what I hear of it, I would venture to say that Paul Newman will be up for an Academy Award for this.
Do you usually find that the films that feel best when they're being shot are the ones that look the best when they're finished?
Yes, I think so, because I remember when I was doing Romeo and Juliet in Rome, the days I was off. Mind you, funny enough, I was doing two films at this one time. I was under contract to Paramount at that period. And they knew I wanted to play Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet. So they said, right, we'll let you play Friar Lawrence if you will play in another film. So I said, right, fine, what is the film? So they said it's with Jane Fonda in Barbarella. So naturally I thought, well, obviously I'll do Romeo and Juliet and then I'll do Barbarella. But I was wrong because I had to shoot the two of them at the same time. So one day I'd be out either on location or in Cinecittà doing Romeo and Juliet. The next day I'd be out in Dino De Laurentiis' studio. And invariably I'd be at the wrong studio because the Italians are crazy people anyway, who I love very much. And invariably I was sent to the wrong studio and then be ringing up and saying, you're at the wrong studio and you should be at this place or that place. And but it was great fun and very exciting. And when I finished those two films, I came back to Broadway to do, funnily enough, a two-character play with Eli Wallach called Staircase. And we opened on Broadway very successfully, and we'd been running for about 6 or 7 weeks. And the Paramount people came out to see the play, and they were very impressed. And came around and said, congratulations on your Tony nomination. And they said, by the way, we're flying you back to Rome because Roger Vadim was then Jane Fonda's husband. He had directed Barbarella. Roger Vadim wants you to fly back to Rome to do another scene with Jane and to do a new death scene, which he'd invented or thought up for me. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, I can't leave. I'm doing this play. I couldn't leave the run of this play. And they said, oh, no, that's all right. Paramount are buying out the Biltmore. And that's what they did. They bought the theatre out on Broadway. And they flew me back to Rome. And I finished the show on Saturday, the matinee on Saturday and the night show on Saturday. And then they flew me out on Sunday. And then I shot in Rome with Jane on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. And then they flew me back on Thursday. And, I had to do the matinee and the night show on Thursday back on Broadway, which was killing. I was jet lag and all that sort of thing. I didn't know where I was.
Did they buy it especially so that they could fly over?
Yes, they bought the theater out.
Wow. Pretty extravagant.
Well, that's the way they are in films. And actually, it turned out to be a tremendous success. In fact, it's now
a cult film.
Yeah. That's true.
Well, there was a period when Jane Fonda was very embarrassed by it when she first started developing her political persona.
Yes, well, that was before Jane really... At that period, Jane was very happily married to Vadim. And the thing I always admired about Jane was her completely professional approach. She never played the fact that she was the director's wife. She was always there on time, in costume, in makeup. She'd always run the scenes, the dialogue. She'd always know her dialogue. And there was never any hold-up. With Jane. She was always ready there and on the spot. She was very nice to me because at that period my wife was busy. My wife was playing Kate in Kiss Me Kate in England. And she knew I was on my own, so she invariably used to invite me back to her place with Vadim, and we'd go back, and she's a wonderful cook, and she would make a lovely meal, and she was very sweet and very nice. I've always liked her.
How did you feel when she became embarrassed about the movie?
Well, she was going through another phase. I wonder how she feels about it now. You know, she's gone through a number of these phases. And, I must say I wasn't very impressed. I didn't like being associated with it then because I was... I suppose that was a breakthrough, really. It was the first really outer space film that was made. And... I like being in things that are breakthrough. Like, for instance, the play I was doing, Staircase, was the first homosexual play that was ever on Broadway. That was a great breakthrough, and my agent didn't want me to do that. My agent didn't want me to do Ulysses originally. They said it was, well, this is a rather weird film, and I don't think you should do it. But, I wanted to do it. And for instance, this play I'm doing at the moment, Mass Appeal, was a great breakthrough. It's the first Catholic play that was really a commercial success in Broadway. And that's why all these other ones have been coming up some of which have been successful and some of which haven't.
You know, I've noticed sometimes when an actor plays a homosexual that they make sure to get lots of photographs with their wife in magazines so that nobody confuses the role with reality. Did your agent advise you to do things like that?
No, I don't think that ever worried me. A number of people have said, how did you play, you know, a homosexual, you know, opposite Eli Wallach, who, of course, is happily married too, to Annie Jackson. In fact, they've just opened recently on a play at Broadway. What I did was I tried to imagine how I'd feel if he was a girl, if he was, you know, and I was falling in love. I was having a love affair with him. You just put a lady there. And that's what I did. I don't quite know what he did, but that's what I did, and that's how I... And unfortunately, there again, they made a film of it, you know, and they made a complete hames of the film because Richard Burton and Rex Harrison played the part, and instead of playing it as it is, a love affair, it's a film about a love affair. And they played it sort of, well, you know that we know that I'm not, and you know that, you know. And so it meant nothing. And it was a very bad film. And I think they were a little ashamed of it, and rightly so.
It's a funny thing. Like, no one would go around saying, hey, did you hear Milo Shea must really be a priest?
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's starring in Mass Appeal.
Yes, yeah,
is it something you've ever talked about with other actors? You know, about what it means when you play the role of a gay person?
Yes. Yeah, but you know, what you are in the pulpit or up on the bench as a judge or in a play with a homosexual, it's really nothing to do with who you are. I think basically I'm a very ordinary person. I'm very, well, I wouldn't say dull person, but I'm not a, you know, the parts that I play are very exciting or amazing or extraordinary, from a homosexual to a priest or a judge or a doctor or any sort of character. I think they're very exciting because you are putting into a capsule a tremendous amount of emotion and music or dancing or tears or laughter into a very short space of time. Whereas, you know, the things I do throughout the day before I'm in the theatre are very mundane, ordinary things. I usually go to a film if I've time, or else I'm doing something like this, which is... I like talking about the characters I play rather about myself, because I think I'm a very ordinary person, really.
I guess Peter Sellers is the most dramatic example I can think of somebody who allegedly never was really sure of who he was and used to graft on the personality of the characters that he was playing.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt like that?
Well, no, not really. No, I don't think so, because Peter, who is a lovely man, was more an impersonator. He would be the part rather than being himself. I think my characterizations are extensions of myself rather than impersonations. I think there's a great difference there. And Peter felt very inadequate himself as a person. He would prefer not to play himself. He would play give an impersonation of a character.
Let's get back to the play that you're starring in now, Mass Appeal. There are a lot of bits of timing that you really have to get into to make the lines work. What are some of the things that you think about in a comedy like this, where it's not a slapstick comedy, it's just in the language and in the timing?
Well, when you talk about timing, yes, you're absolutely right. That's terribly important. It's like a musician tuning up, practicing his scales in the dressing room, or an opera singer running over his scales. Usually what Adam and I, or whoever has played the part before, I like to come in early, you know, about 7 o'clock, and run lines. In other words, to get the rhythms, to get the juices flowing, to get the shades, the lights and shades and colors and the varieties. Because I think it's very important. And once you do that for about 10 or 15 minutes, you're almost in tune. And so when you come out, it's not a sort of a, you're not warming up with your opening a sermon, you're actually into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important. And I think an awful lot of actors don't do that. And I think that's unwise. I think it's very important, like a musician or like a creative artist, too, that you must practice. You mustn't just, after you've finished rehearsals and the opening night, just walk into the theater and expect yourself suddenly to come out on the stage and be at a level of performance right away. I don't think that's possible.
Yeah, I guess maybe sometimes you have a hard time convincing other actors to participate in that, huh?
Well, sometimes, yes. But I think it's very important. This particular production of Massabee was a great team effort. In other words, originally it was done in the Roundabout Theatre. I wasn't in that production. And then we did it off-Broadway in the Manhattan Theatre Club. And it was really, as I say, a team production in that Geraldine Fitzgerald, who was our producer, and incidentally, I think it was a very good idea having a lady director directing two men in a piece written by another man. Because it was a team effort, we all got together, and for instance, the final sermon in Mass Appeal was written or rewritten 27 times. And you just keep at it until you get it perfect, until you get it right. And so many plays, I think, are rushed onto Broadway. It's like an athlete rushing a boxer into a title fight before he's ready. It's the same with an actor and a play. It's very wise to hold back, as Geraldine did. Geraldine did, as I say, a reading of it down in the Roundabout. Then she did the off-Broadway. Then she took it to Dublin to iron some kinks out there. Then we took it to Boston. And then finally onto Broadway. And this, I think, was very wise, and it paid off.
It certainly did. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed.
Milo O'Shea has been my guest, and he's now starring in Mass Appeal at the Walnut Street Theater. Mass Appeal will continue there through November 28th, and for more information, you can call 574-3550. That's 574-3550. And in about 2 or 3 weeks, a film called The Verdict should be opening, and Milo O'Shea appears in the role of the judge in that film, which also stars Paul Newman. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
It's 20 minutes to 3.